And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
This morning I went outside, turned on the hose, and washed my truck. I did not take that for granted, for but by the grace of God, I could find my life changed forever by Katrina. The human tragedy is yet to be determined. The price we all pay will be staggering. Today, we get an overview of Katrina's effects, and we find out how the wild creatures in the Gulf Coast zoos coped during the storm of the ages, when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Come gather round, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone.
The times, they are a-changing. Bob Dylan's ever-prophetic words written in 1963 are filled to overflowing with meaning to us now. As a naturalist and environmentalist, it's difficult to know what really to say. I want to welcome you all back to the Wild Side News. I've been on a special assignment for the past few weeks, and it's good to be back doing this show. But it is the most difficult show I've done. This past week has been extremely difficult for me and for my friends. It's been difficult on many of us who have watched with horror the struggles for help that went on day after day after day. But who are we who watch to mention our suffering compared to those who lived through it and who must now grapple with recreating a life from scratch? I scour the daily environmental news alerts, and I found a most amazing phenomenon this past week. The environmental community has been strangely silent. And although I know why, I cannot really effectively put it into words. Those of us who love nature feel nature. We sense its power and majesty, often with a sensitivity so attuned that a butterfly can take our breath away. I felt this storm coming. A week ago Monday, I was up on the West Coast at 4 a.m. to experience what I knew was going to be a huge historic event. Initially, it was exciting to see the news people blown about by the winds, to watch the phenomenal force of nature whipping trees about like weeds. But the winds kept coming, stronger and stronger, and the stories began spreading of the size and scale of the storm. The worst fears that New Orleans would lie directly in the path of the storm were not realized, as Biloxi became the forward front of force. And then Lake Pontchartrain was discussed, and the levees, and the storm surge, and it has not stopped since then. As in all other hurricanes, the news had the pictures of thousands of cars leaving the city, headlights in the storm. And I was one of millions who wondered if I would have left, and thousands did not. And that is the story of the deluge of New Orleans, which continues as we speak. The stories of terror, fear, abandonment, and loss are literally too many to tell. And as we listen to this show, we must prepare ourselves for even greater shocks. I guess this is America's closest experience to real war. War in the homeland. I think of Hiroshima or Nagasaki. I think of the many now all over the earth who live with the terror and the hunger, the brutality and shame that now we must face each day. There are no lessons to learn yet. Those will come, and only time will write them on the future. For now, it is ours to survey the state of our chaos and pain, for that is the story of the land. We do what we can to give you a slice through the rubble as we hear from Daryl Malik Wiley, who has spent years working from New Orleans for the Sierra Club. His personal saga and perspective will take us through segments 1 and 2. In our third segment, we take a look at the region's special creatures, those forced to endure the storm held in cages, pens, and special places in the region's zoos. How do the animals do? We will get an update from Jane Ballantyne, Director of Public Affairs for the American Zoo and Aquarium Association. We hope today's show will give you real information about our nation, our people, our hopes, and our dreams to come. So now, the story of Katrina.
There is probably no effective way to encapsulate what the storm really means to us now and even in the future, not at this point. So all that we can do is try to learn as we go, and certainly someone who has had a lot of experience literally in New Orleans and Louisiana is Daryl Malik Wiley, who is joining us now from San Francisco. But he's been working in the environmental justice organizing realms in Louisiana for the Sierra Club. Daryl, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thank you, Sydney. Glad to be here.
Well, I don't even know where to begin. Why don't you, first of all, let's just take time to have you give us a sense of what you perceive when you think about this storm. What are you seeing since you have really firsthand info? You've been down there. Give us a little background, first of all, about how long you've been down there and kind of the realm that you've worked in and the regions that you've covered and your familiarity with that environment down there.
Right. Well, I've been in Louisiana since 1982. I moved to New Orleans at that time and have been working with communities up and down the Mississippi River from Baton Rouge south through New Orleans to Chalmette and beyond. So mainly working with poor African-American communities that are next to giant petrochemical facilities. I thought I had seen every kind of environmental tragedy, but my awareness of tragedy got so much bigger this week.
Well, give us a sense of that region. How would you define that region and its people and the nature of it? You know, there's a matrix that it's not Nebraska.
Right, it's not Nebraska. It's Louisiana has 20% of the nation's petrochemical industry. And the majority of that is along the Mississippi River from Baton Rouge to past New Orleans. It's, you know, termed Cancer Alley because of concerns about chemical emissions. But the culture of the city itself is a rich mix of people and cultures. The city, of course, was settled by the French, but the reason the French settled the city where it is because it was a Native American trade route. So they saw commerce with Native American peoples. Then you had the French. Then you had people brought in as, you know, settling German, Irish, Spanish, Canary Islands, the Philippines, unfortunately all the slaves brought in from different parts of Africa, and the latest sort of wave into New Orleans has been the people displaced after the Vietnam War, so there's a whole vibrant Vietnamese-American community there. So it's a very much a metropolitan, cosmopolitan city with so much culture and food and jazz. Everybody knows about music and food coming out of New Orleans. But it's also the strong neighborhood associations and feelings. New Orleans is a city of neighborhoods. You know, you live and you talk to your neighbors. Unlike some American cities where you don't know who lives next to you, the city of New Orleans, you know not only who lives next to you, but who lives next to them, and there's, you know, a real sense of community, and that's one reason people didn't want to leave. They were afraid for their neighbors. There was also the economic issues. 30% of the population in New Orleans lives below the poverty level, and that's mainly African-American. So you have a very poor city, and you have this natural and human catastrophe come down upon it.
And just to be fair, I'm one who believes that just because a person doesn't have a lot of money doesn't
right.
mean there's anything in any way, shape, or form wrong with them. And as
right.
a matter of fact, obviously they've been able to organize a lifestyle there that has allowed them to survive. It's
right.
not as if they're all just sitting around starving to death. They had a culture. They had a mechanism to survive down there that was a way of life.
They, you know, and it's a very rich culture. There are lots of extended families, you know, grandmothers and mothers and fathers and sisters and aunts and, you know, this extended family. And they'd have, you know, community gardens. You know, if you didn't have something, you'd go by your cousin and he'd have something to help you out. So, you know, money's not everything. And New Orleans was better at dealing with not having, you know, some of the, quote, good things by having this rich cultural heritage, and you know, you just feel the music that's come out of the town, you know, and like I said, money's not everything.
Mm-hmm. Well, now let's start getting into the story of this storm.
Right.
Where were you when you started hearing about the storm, and then how did you? What were your thoughts?
Right. Well, you know, I was in New Orleans when I first started hearing about the storm, and you know, this storm developed very rapidly in that. First projections were that it was going to cross the state of Florida and then almost turn directly north, hitting Florida again. But the storm didn't want to do that. So it kept drifting west, and the further west it drifted, the more concerned people in New Orleans and along the Mississippi Gulf Coast became. So I started... You know, the hurricane procedure, what you do, all the house plants. My wife has a green thumb. I mean, she's just amazing with plants. And they're all outside in pots, so all those have to go into the house. Then you start looking for, you know, anything that'll blow, because you don't want anything, you know, blowing, picked up in the storm and damaging somebody else's house. So you try and, you know, all the garden furniture, all the trash cans, anything, you know, took all the hoses off of the house, you know, and put them in the house and into the storage shed in the back. And so, you know, basically it's a gigantic personal cleanup job that everybody's going through. And then some folks put plywood up on their windows. We didn't have time to do that because the time frame was much compressed. Then on Saturday, I guess the mayor started calling, in New Orleans, called for voluntary evacuation and then saying that he was going to go to mandatory evacuation on Sunday. So people started filtering out of the town in large numbers, not only Orleans, but Jefferson Parish, St. Bernard, Plaquemine, all the coastal communities. And we left our home at 5 a.m. on Sunday morning. And instead of getting in the traffic of I-10, which was the major evacuation route, because I've worked up and down the Mississippi River and know all the back roads, we took all the back roads and basically did not hit traffic until we got to the Louisiana-Texas border when, because of a bridge being out, we were forced back to Interstate 10. And we were on 10 for a little while. Then we cut once again on the back roads get to my brother-in-law's house, which is north of Houston. So that's where we ended up. We displaced one of the daughters and lived in her bedroom, and my mother-in-law was in the other bedroom. So we all successfully evacuated, but then we started seeing the images of the storm, and it's just heart-wrenching. The questions of not knowing what's going on your home, and for me, the added thing of not knowing what's going on to the all the hundreds of people I've worked with through the years in their communities.
So as you were leaving, did you have a sense that perhaps this was going to be get out of control, that this wasn't
No.
there wasn't going to be a happy ending to this?
No. You know, I packed 3 days' clothes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we thought that it would, you know, maybe, because it was tended to graze more to the east, we thought didn't think it was going to be this large of an event as far as the devastation of New Orleans. And, you know, when the storm passed itself, the city did not get a whole lot of damage from wind or rain.
It's true.
And what happened was this delayed effect that impacted with the levees failing. So we didn't know when we left that we would not be back to our home for months now, or, you know, we don't know when we're going to be able to be allowed back into New Orleans.
Hmm.
And that's very, you know, my wife and I are both having, you know, waking up in the middle of the night, worrying about different things. We had a number of cats that they were neighborhood cats. They, you know, we had gotten them fixed into the vet, and, you know, they came to our house for food, but they were not inside cats. We don't know what's happened to them. There's so many different things going on, you know, psychologically. It's just there are definitely good moments and bad moments. The good moments are when I hear that somebody I know is out and safe.
There's obviously quite a bit of talk right now about the fact that many people left and many people didn't.
Right.
And that's going to be tossed around in the political realms as to, you know, what's the cause for that.
Right.
I'm just curious, which, you know, because you live there, because you have this sense, and you also have really been working with the community, perhaps more so than many who, the community that didn't leave, what do you think were their thoughts? What was their thinking? What was their reason for not leaving? There are many, I'm sure. It's totally diverse, but
right.
Give us a sense.
You know, there are a wide range of why people did not leave. You know, some, they're just economically, there was no way. It was at the end of the month. If they were on, support from the federal government, their check hadn't come in yet. So at the end of the month, you don't have no money. So you didn't have money to put gas in the car if you had a car. If you had a car, there was no guarantee that your car would make a 200-mile journey. Some cars just don't do that, you know. We're talking about 30% of the population below the poverty level. There's also folks that own a home, and that's all they've got in the world is their home and what's in it. And they were afraid that if they left, somebody might try and take what they own. There are people who are sick and ill that couldn't get out. It's a wide range of human, you know, decisions. Every person in New Orleans had to make a decision to go or not go based on their own personal experiences, knowledge, and what they were seeing on television. Some people had wrote out hurricanes in New Orleans before, and they said, no, it wasn't a problem, you know, so it's a wide range, and we'll never know all the stories because we won't be interviewing everybody.
Let's expand this out, too, because I imagine you've traveled extensively throughout Louisiana and Mississippi,
right,
and Alabama and that area. As you're hearing the reports now, what is your sense of the status or the nature of this storm to that region?
I think it's devastated the Mississippi Gulf Coast in a way that it didn't devastate New Orleans. You know, it was direct impact from storm surge and wind. And, you know, the pictures I see there of the crushed houses and the gambling casinos blown across the highway, and, you know, that's the devastation most people think about when they hear about hurricanes. What we're seeing in New Orleans is more insidious, in that we've got floodwaters contaminated with who knows what that are now becoming part of the buildings, part of any clothes in the buildings, and have probably impacted people's health who walk through the waters. So it's just, I don't know, the more I read and, you know, watch different media reports, and the more I, you know, just my personal understanding of what chemicals are in the city and in the refineries down from the city, the nation has never experienced this type of natural and human event. And how we respond to this, I believe, will set the tone for how great a country we are or aren't. If we respond with justice for all, I think we will become a greater America. If we respond with justice for the few, I think we'll be, all of us as Americans will be diminished.
Let's take a look at, I'd like to hear your perspective as you look at the region. We're going to come back to some of the specifics in New Orleans, but there are also what I suppose environmentalists have in the past referred to as certain types of hot spots that suddenly we need to be aware of. We're probably not even aware of them yet, but because you're on the ground there, because this is your realm, what would you say are some of the areas that we need to really think about? In reality, there's so many different aspects, but why don't you give us your thoughts?
Right, yeah, and I'm just, you know, I'm just getting in reports from people I've talked with and what I've seen on television, but in Mississippi, there's a DuPont facility, DuPont Chemicals, that on Friday before the storm, the in a lawsuit, the jury awarded a gentleman exposed to dioxin coming out of the DuPont plant to a $14 million settlement. Now, all the dioxin that had contaminated the waterway and this gentleman is now spread in a much wider range because my understanding is a third of the plant has been impacted negatively, and water has washed upon the DuPont facility and then taken these dioxins and who else knows what other type of chemicals out of the facility and into the environment.
And just remind listeners what dioxin really, the effects that dioxin has.
Right. Dioxin is one of the most toxic chemicals that's been made by man. And there's a wide range of health impacts that have been argued about, but some of it, and there's a whole range of different dioxins. There's a whole range of different chemical compounds that are branched under the name dioxin. Some of them are associated with cancer causing. Some of them are associated with different kind of rashes and dermatological outbreaks. And very small amounts of dioxin can cause serious impacts to living organisms.
And where is that located?
That's located, it's in Mississippi, near Pascagoula.
Pascagoula, yeah. So fairly coastal.
Yeah, the plant was actually back on the, bayou, and let me think, the name of the town, because I was talking with somebody there yesterday, DeLisle. It's DELISE. But it's called, and my Mississippi pronunciation is not great. You know, people talk about New Orleans. We don't have a southern accent in New Orleans. It's just a very cosmopolitan city, so I don't have the Mississippi accent on Toledo.
Mm-hmm. Very good. You might also help us understand, listeners understand the nature of the petrochemical industry. I mean, this is a thank God for it. You know, we all rely on these things, but this just happened to be in the way of this storm. And what are you hearing in terms of?
Well, in terms of the storm, you know, people need to understand that since the 1950s, the coastal wetlands of Louisiana have been crisscrossed by oil and natural gas exploration canals, and those canals directly led to the destruction of the marsh. The majority of America's oil and natural gas is coming from offshore Louisiana. And so that gas and oil is, there are offshore oil rigs now that pump up oil, put it into pipelines, and then it's shipped onshore for processing in Louisiana, mm-hmm. both the natural gas and the oil. So in Chalmette, which is one of the communities I was working in, there were two oil refineries. One was a ExxonMobil facility called Chalmette Refining, LLC, and the other is Murphy Oil. So those refineries get the oil either from the pipelines or from ocean-going ships that come up to their dock, and they refine that oil into our modern, you know, petroleum economy. Gasoline, kerosene, jet fuel, diesel, everything that America runs on. So,
as well as all sorts of secondary and tertiary
right.
petrochemicals. Yeah.
That, you know, there's all sorts of, you know, in Chalmette, they're just the two, oil refineries, but, you know, up the river, they're the petrochemical industries that are making herbicides, pesticides. Louisiana is rich in natural resources. It's got oil, natural gas, salt, which is the chlorides, which is one of the building blocks of modern chemistry, and sulfur. So the petrochemical industry came to Louisiana for those raw building blocks, and they also came because the Mississippi River is navigable by ocean-going ships from the mouth of the river to New Orleans, which is about 120 miles, and then further up the river to Baton Rouge, which is another 120 miles by the river. The Mississippi River is a very winding, deltaic river. New Orleans to Baton Rouge is about 80 miles on the interstate, but by the river it's 120 miles. And so you have, you know, Dow Chemical, you have BASF Corporation, you have Shell Oil, you have Formosa Plastic, you have any, you know, most every major petrochemical company or oil company has a facility in Louisiana.
Question two, from the oil derricks. Now, if a derrick offshore
right.
Derrick goes down, some people are concerned, well, you know, the oil has to get up to that derrick.
Right.
If that breaks or those pipes fissure, are there safety mechanisms to shut off those pipelines?
Right. There are different safeguards that they've got built into their oil drilling system. One, they've got valves at the sort of the seafloor that are supposed to close if they sense a break. Then they have valves up in the platform itself, and then there are different series of safety valves along the pipelines. But one of the concerns we have, the pipelines in some areas are buried, but they're designed to be buried, but they're not designed to be buried and then under 12 foot of water. So we don't know how that's impacting the hydrology of the soils and if there's causing any breakage of pipes. We've seen some of the breaking of pipes in the city of New Orleans itself. You've seen video footage of the gas bubbling up and catching on fire, the natural gas.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and those pipelines are very small, going to individual houses or businesses or 3/4 of an inch or an inch in diameter. But the pipelines down in St. Bernard and other parts of Louisiana are 12 inches, 20 inches, 24 inches. So, you know, orders of magnitude larger amounts of natural gas and other chemicals.
Are you getting any reports in terms of the status then of that whole petrochemical industry where, you know, the successes and the failures?
Right. Not a whole lot. And it's part of the frustration, you know, in not being in Louisiana, I had to fly to this meeting, this national meeting in the Sierra Club, which has been planned for over a year and a half. So I have not on the ground in Baton Rouge been able to go corner state agency folks and just say, okay, tell me what's going on. I'll be doing that when I get back next Wednesday.
So what of the great city? When we return, we continue this update with Daryl Malik Wiley when your Voice of the Earth returns here on the Wild Side News.